As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726. Or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Welcome back to the Pandemoscene podcast, where we attempt to produce knowledge that orients us towards justice at this critical historical juncture. Today, we welcome you to a conversation with Dr. Ruth Mueller, Associate Professor of Science and Technology Policy in the Munich Center of Technology and Society at the Technical University of Munich. Dr. Mueller has been an SJRC visiting scholar several times and maintains long-term collaborations with Dr. Martha Kenny, whose interview we aired during last week's episode, and who is a graduate of UCSC and the Science and Justice Training Program herself. This interview was conducted on September 15th of this year by undergraduate SJRC fellow Issa Ansari and graduate student SJTP fellows Dennis Brow and Paloma Medina. Throughout this conversation, we talk about the COVID-19 related projects Dr. Mueller is working on, how her training as an STS scholar has informed her understandings of this pandemic, why interdisciplinary work is important, and how it can continue to be supported in research settings moving forward. We begin this episode diving directly into Dr. Mueller's reflections on how she has focused her energy and responded to the COVID-19 pandemic in its earliest stages during mid-March of 2020.
So all these kinds of catching up, getting on the same page and trying to figure out what's going on, I think this was one of the first things that really happened. And I have to say the first few months were really absolutely covered with this kind of work, just, you know, being there for the students and trying to be there for friends, be there for family, particularly also with friends in the US, make sure they have the information that they need with older family. My partner is from New York, so in New York was so hit so hard in the beginning. So we have, his parents are there, we have family there. So we were doing calls with them when the information landscape in the US was still kind of more fragile than it was in Germany at this point in time. So it was a lot of this kind of just care work in terms of trying to figure out how we deal with this. And if I'm being very honest, in the very beginning, when there were people who were writing about COVID in an academic sense, like very early on, I was almost a little bit, how do I phrase this politely? I was like, okay, it seems like you have the resources to do this, right? To start an intellectual debate, which is of course important, but it was my experience, and I know also that experience of a number of colleagues around us, that it was more these like immediate ways of taking care of people that were in the center.
So with that in mind, could you tell us a bit about any COVID-19 related projects that you've worked on or that you're currently working on and how they took shape?
So what I did is I talked to a couple of journalists, particularly in that period. So in the beginning, I think that I don't know how much you know about how things were going here in Germany in terms of the political landscape and the relationship between science and policy here. So we had, of course, a very different experience than in the US, right? So here there was, may I say, a bit of better leadership in terms of how to deal with this crisis, in terms of more scientific explanation for what's going on and a more concise approach to what needs to happen, and a way more cautious approach. And that was kind of well supported by most of the public in the beginning. And then there was kind of this point where it was clear this is not a 2 or 3 week thing. This is a much more long-term thing. And then some people in the public became upset about, oh, are now the scientists ruling our society? Is this like the rule of experts now, right? Are we doing everything the scientists are telling us? what about democracy and so on and so forth. And there was contact, for example, by a journalist from the science part of a European newspaper who wanted to write a piece about this relationship between science and policy. And so I was talking to her a lot about questions, for example, about the precautionary principle. What does that mean? Why is it important that if we have a pandemic situation, that we, in a sense, do not rely only on what we know, but take what we do not know very seriously. And that, in a sense, we need, if we don't know how dangerous this can be and for whom, we need to be more cautious rather than just act on what we already know, right? So I found myself talking to different people a lot about this question of the precautionary principle and why this is an important cornerstone of protecting societies and particularly vulnerable groups in society from harm that might come from something we haven't understood yet. So this was one thing. And then I started talking to, and this is maybe the piece you already also know that I wrote with a couple of colleagues for the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology, where I so I have a very good colleague in Southampton. He's a life scientist. He's working a lot on the developmental origins of health and disease. So these questions of how social and economic contexts shape health trajectories through the life course. His name is Mark Hansen. And he's a very senior, very renowned scholar in his field. And we met a number of years ago and have since then been working on questions of social justice and biology. And so he got in touch and was like, we should say something about COVID and we should say something about kind of this question of social justice. And particularly also, he works a lot on women's and children's health. And so this question of what the groups in society who are maybe less immediately impacted by the pandemic, but who will carry a lot of the costs in the long term. What about those groups, right? So both like, what about the groups that are immediately vulnerable here, but also how do we need to think in the long term to not have, for example, what does it mean for children today to grow up in a pandemic setting, right? How does this, might that impact their long-term health? So he was really interested in working on this, and my colleague Martha Kenny and Michael Pankler came on board for this too. And we had long discussions, what can we write about? Because there was just at that point so much coming out and so many commentaries, and it felt like the entire scientific landscape is dominated by all things COVID. So we really kind of were wondering, what can we say that's meaningful? And we were also absolutely prepared not to say anything if we, because this rush to just everyone has to say something about COVID, that's just not something I want to run with, right? I feel like we should only publish when we actually have something to say. And so we ended up focusing on this question or this idea of going back to normal, and that is actually a horrendous idea, that we cannot go back to normal if we look at the enormous impact of social inequality on health, on well-being, on a chance to live, that the pandemic has revealed. This rhetoric of going back to normal is just really deadly. And so we focused on this question and wrote a small commentary for the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. And we were specifically trying to get this piece into a medical journal, because discussions that might be much more normal for us in the social sciences and humanities are not necessarily as everyday for many practitioners in the medical and life sciences. And so that was important for us. We didn't write a long thing. We just had a few things to say that we wanted to say, and we did that.
Focusing on the interplay between science policy and the public sphere in the context of a pandemic is necessarily an interdisciplinary project. As there is no part of society that COVID-19 has not affected, an integrated approach to COVID-19-related research is essential if it is going to have a useful impact. We talked with Dr. Mueller a bit about what that looks like in the front lines of the medical field before moving on to discuss how, structurally, interdisciplinary work can continue to be supported beyond the pandemic.
And I think this is something that I really like at the university where I'm at, that there's actually a lot of interdisciplinary a lot of possibility for interdisciplinary work and a lot of interest. So I think this is something that I really appreciate here. And, you know, we're, as a social scientist at the Technical University of Munich, we're a minority, but at the same time, there's so many colleagues in other fields who are very interested in thinking about issues together and seeing how we can integrate technical questions or social questions and come up with different types of solutions. And yeah. And I think for many people, COVID-19 made that even more visible that we always need these types of integrated approaches.
How structurally can that interdisciplinary work be supported and continue past, you know, this moment, as you're saying? So, like, how do you ensure that doesn't fizzle out?
That's a very good point. And I think a lot of that is up to university leadership and research funding, right? Those are really two key components for enabling interdisciplinary work and making sure that we really can develop and maintain long-term interdisciplinary projects and collaborations. Again, I'm in a quite fortunate situation that I'm at a university that is really interested in maintaining this kind of work and offers different formats like seed funding from the university to start projects so that you can mature them to a point where you then might be able to bring this interdisciplinary project to a funder, because it's always a bit more difficult to develop an interdisciplinary project than a disciplinary project. So that also really encourages people to actually think this way, right? So I think that's really important. And then, yeah, the research funding landscape really matters, right? So how does a funding call look that addresses an important topic, a topic that's important for society, right? Are you just saying, oh, we want some more medical research on COVID-19? Or are you saying we're interested in funding a consortium that brings together different perspectives so we can actually develop a broad knowledge base to figure out how to better deal with this challenge in society? And I think funders in different countries have gotten around to that to different degrees. And I think overall, I think we're doing pretty well here in Germany. There's a lot of funders like who really want that kind of work. Then there's the next step to find the review panels who are able to actually evaluate that kind of work and put these kinds of perspectives together. But yeah, I think those are really important aspects, and I'm sure there needs to be a little bit of space for trial and error as well, right, to figure out what works and how to put these different perspectives together.
I think that this question builds off of actually the question that Paloma just asked and the answers that you just gave. So to quote the article that you co-authored and that you just mentioned, Back to Normal, Building Community Resilience After COVID-19, you write that social justice is fundamental to promoting health in society. Greater resilience to health emergencies requires systemic rather than individual change. And so I was wondering if you see any areas within scientific research practices or the structure of higher education more broadly that you think need change in order to contribute to this status quo shift. I think you just mentioned it a little bit in terms of interdisciplinary work.
I think there's actually a lot of areas that could do with some change. A very fundamental thing is how researchers learn to think about their research. If we stick with the medical sciences, or let's say the life sciences and medical sciences for a moment, I'll give an example, like the field of epigenetics and developmental origins of health and disease, which I myself and a number of researchers in my group are engaging quite a bit, looks a lot at issues of how, for example, early life nutrition or nutrition during pregnancy might affect later life health in terms of metabolic health or illness and these kinds of issues. So if researchers report on, let's say, cohort studies where they find a correlation between certain types of nutrition or the unfortunate proxy of body weight and later life health outcomes, right? Or the nutrition of mother during pregnancy. You have a choice when you write, for example, the interpretation of your results in the discussion and conclusion section, right? Usually what happens is that we find a sentence like this there. This shows how lifestyle choices really impact health trajectories across generations. We thus need to invest in the education of parents and particularly mothers so that they can make informed choices about their nutrition. So this is a deeply individualistic narrative that locates responsibility with the mothers in this case and with the individuals more generally, and does absolutely obscure the different societal structures that also produce different access to healthy foods, different availabilities of time, different desires, and so on and so forth, right? So if I had more training in questions of social justice, health equity, and the relationship between society and health more generally in a curriculum for bioscientists or medical researchers, then, for example, the same article with possibly even the exactly same findings could have a conclusion that says our findings strengthen the calls for greater food justice in society. For example, the making available of better food resources for children and mother through collective food infrastructures and so on and so forth, right? So same research, entirely different framing, entirely different link to a health policy. And what I find is that when I interact with researchers from the biosciences, that it is not their firm belief that each individual is to be held responsible for their food choices. They are well aware that there's wider social context, but they have not learned that these wider social context is something that they could include and address with their work, that could be something that could be part of their repertoire of writing, of articulating their work and its relevance. And the interesting thing is that they often think if they stick with the individual centered rhetoric, that they're being non-political, that this is for some reason neutral, and kind of making them aware that already by choosing one narrative, they're always already political. That often has this kind of, I'm already doing something political. So I could actually also do something differently political with my work. And so kind of raising this awareness that whatever we do in whichever scientific field we are in is always already political, and that we need to be aware of the frames we're using as we're talking about our research. And of course, not only in terms of discussion and interpretation of results, but then at some point it ideally echoes back in the research into the research questions I ask, the design of the research that I put together, the selection of the participants, and so on and so forth. But it can start with the small point of awareness that just how I frame my work and what kind of political discourses I relate to already makes a huge impact.
We move on now to talk about how Dr. Mueller's training as an STS scholar has shaped how she is thinking through the pandemic and how it has informed her sensitivity to eugenic discourse. For those who do not know, STS stands for Science, Technology, and Society Studies, and is a field that looks critically at the relationship between technology, society, and science in the production, distribution, and utilization of scientific knowledge.
Yeah, in terms of the STS tools, I think one of the things that I've mentioned earlier was to kind of, I've developed a stubborn insistence on the issue of the precautionary principle, right? Because there was all like, so for example, we know at this point, but only in a vague way still, that most probably COVID-19 doesn't necessarily spread as much as we thought through contact with surfaces, right? So there have been very few infections clusters linked to contact with surfaces. So, and a common public reaction is that then people are like, oh, we did all of this for nothing, right? We had all these measures in place, and then there's not even a risk. But in fact, a better way to think about this is, isn't this great? We were careful, and we avoided this issue that we didn't know about. And now we can move on and maybe roll back certain measures because we now know it's safe. But this insistence that particularly to protect the most vulnerable in our society, we need to be overly cautious in a situation of uncertainty. And it's very interesting. It was very interesting to me to see that that kind of thinking was not very common in public discourse. And there were all kinds of weird conversations that I had around these issues. For example, some people were saying, well, you know, of course there's more people dying now, but won't we get up to those numbers anyway at some point, and the people will just be dying spread out across a longer period of time? And I was like, no. Hello, can I introduce medicine to you? Medicine is a learning system. Getting sick with COVID-19 in March is entirely different to getting sick with COVID-19 in July, because then medicine has learned a million things about it, and it has learned a million things about it. We have now different combinations of medications that can be used for different patients with different pre-existing conditions. We know how to better ventilate people. We have better testing infrastructure. We catch the disease earlier. So it's such a difference in half a year what it means to fall sick with COVID-19. So it's not like the people that are dying in March would then die anyway in July. No, this is not how a disease works, and this is not how medicine works. I felt like I encountered in many different discussions, also with colleagues, so this is not necessarily a question of education. I encountered different ways of legitimizing not to care for those most vulnerable in society, right? Different forms of calculating and rationalizing why we shouldn't do X, Y, and Z that cuts into the way we're usually living in society. And I think that SDS tools, like thinking about issues like the precautionary principle, or thinking about how medicine works, right? What is the knowledge process of medicine, were very helpful for me basically to say, no, we need to follow a very cautionary approach because we're in a situation of great uncertainty. And the cautionary approach will allow us, as we gain more knowledge about the situation, to roll back certain measures and not have risked or affected unnecessary deaths. And then the other thing, maybe to throw this in, and this is also definitely connected to the Sweden case, is I think we could really see in the COVID-19 pandemic situation how there is still quite a lot of eugenic thought in our societies. Like how there is still a tendency to divulge too easily into discussions about which life is worth preserving and which life is not worth preserving, right? And these discussions look very differently in different national contexts. I think, interestingly, in a German context, where, of course, eugenic had been very present, but also at the same time, there has been a strong engagement with the eugenic past than necessarily in other countries. There was a very clear narrative of kind of, we're going to try to save every life. In other countries, we had, for example, even triage protocols in effect if they were still available ICU beds, where, for example, people over a certain age or people with a certain number of pre-existing conditions did not receive certain treatments, right? Even though there was still capacity. So that was, in a sense, very shocking to me. But on the other hand, if we look at the strong history of eugenics in most parts of the world, really, right? Eugenic thought was something that in the first half of the 20th century was really quite widespread and a relatively normalized way of thinking about health and people and who should live and who not. We've seen a lot of eugenic thought going on in the COVID-19 pandemic, like discussions of, like, oh, should we treat someone who then might only live another year or two? All these kind of practices of weighing which life is worth preserving and which life not. And we need to understand that these kinds, there is no non-eugenic practice of these forms of weighing one life against another. And there might be situations where we're forced to do that. And this is the horror that we've seen in Italy, for example, where hospitals were so overcrowded and had run out of their resources in a way that the doctors had to practice triage and had to practice who they can put on a ventilator and who not. And there were some situations in the US that were similar. But this is the worst case scenario. But if we're having these discussions without this very immediate necessity, this is a eugenic discussion. And I think we need to realize this. And I think this is not something that is necessarily very present in public discourse, that this way of thinking is already eugenics.
Monterey Bay's undocumented workers are overrepresented in the service, hospitality, and agriculture industries, which have all been severely impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. There are over 90,000 undocumented workers in the Monterey Bay area. At the same time, undocumented workers have been excluded from federally and state-funded safety net programs. UndocuFund Monterey Bay is a collaborative effort to provide undocumented workers and their families with a one-time emergency financial assistance. You can learn how to be a part of the solution at UndocuFundMB, all one word, .org.
So we're wondering, you know, how have you been finding hope throughout this pandemic, and what gives you hope for a more livable future?
So one thing that gave me hope were just, like, you know, human acts of solidarity in this situation, like seeing very shortly after the news of the pandemic had arrived, like the first, little note downstairs. I live in an apartment building downstairs, someone writing, are there any people who are particularly at risk or elderly people? Please just let us know. We'll go shopping for you. Like these, you know, small acts of solidarity. I thought that was just seeing how people are trying to help each other out. That is definitely something that gave me some hope.
Our conversation with Dr. Mueller leaves us with so much to think about. How can we continue to center care in our daily pandemic responses? How can science training programs adapt to include more robust ethics requirements, as well as some more general social science competency? Finally, how can we collectively attune ourselves to the prevalence of eugenic discourse during this pandemic in order to avoid falling into these same conversations in the crises sure to come? This interview with Dr. Mueller wraps up the first segment of our Pandemoscene podcast project and reminds us of some of the founding ideals of the Science and Justice Research Center, which understands that the issues we face don't exist in the neat categories of academic fields, but in the messy, overlapping, continuous spaces of our living worlds, where science and socio-political context are in constant communication, and where we prioritize reflexive research that strengthens our movements for justice and our efforts to create a more livable world. As we wrap up, we want to take this time to thank our listeners, all of our guests on the show, the team at KZSC, and our wonderful Pandemoscene team for all of their hard work. Although this wraps up the first segment of our project, we will be back with more content in January 2021. We'll continue with our podcasts and our blog, and dive into mutual aid, the reality of multiple overlapping pandemics, the role of speculative fiction and radical imaginaries, and much, much more. Thank you so much for tuning in.